Hello, world. This is CS50 here on Harvard University's campus, and in particular, we're in the Radcliffe Yard. So nowadays, the Radcliffe Yard is home to the Harvard Admissions Center, as well as the Information Center. So if you're looking to learn a little something about Harvard or apply to Harvard, you can come to this particular spot on campus. But historically, it wasn't actually used for those purposes per se. In fact, the reason that it's called Radcliffe Yard is because this was actually home to what was once Radcliffe College, which was another university that women enrolled in years ago before, unfortunately, Harvard didn't allow women to enroll in it. Indeed, in years ago, a small number of women could enroll in Harvard College classes, but it wasn't until 1972 that the schools truly were co-ed, and in effect, it became Harvard Radcliffe College. In fact, when I myself went to Harvard years ago in the mid-1990s, I technically applied to Harvard Radcliffe College and graduated from the same. And funny enough, the year I graduated, 1999, is when finally Radcliffe College evolved into what's now called the Radcliffe Institute for Research. And the Research Institute now focuses all the more on academics, inclusive of anyone in the university, particularly those housed here. But nowadays, it is indeed Harvard College as the undergraduate part of Harvard University. So allow me to stroll just past you all now here and join CS50's own Carter Zenke for a chat about whatever is on your minds. Hey, Carter.
Oh, hey, David. Fancy seeing you here.
It's so nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too. Just taking some of the beautiful air on this fine quad.
It is. It is nice to be outside here. And so even though this is, in fact, a quadrangle, it's not the Radcliffe Quadrangle, or Quad as it's called, which is actually around the corner and up the street a bit. And that's where a lot of undergraduates nowadays live. There are dormitories, in effect, but back in the day, it's where the women of Radcliffe College used to live, around the corner and down the street. But now everything is much more inclusive and integrated with everyone.
Nice. Well, thanks for the history lesson.
Well, thank you very much. I learned this on the tour, and perhaps a bit of Wikipedia as well.
Nice.
So I think we're here, though, to answer some questions about CS50 and computer science more generally, with our friends Vlad and Max helping us out.
Yeah, a few friends joining us live. I have a few questions we could ask you if you're okay.
All right. All right, sure. Let's do it.
Nice. So one question I see here is, if someone takes CS50X and they're trying to master all the concepts, but they take more than 1 year, is that okay? Or should they think about doing something else?
Yes. So I think it depends on the reasons. I think if you have the time, you should ideally try to spend maybe minimally 3 months, maybe on average 6 to 9 months. Once you hit the 12-month boundary, that's fine too. We've absolutely had students who might take 2 years, maybe even a little more, because they start and stop. But the catch with that is that you probably just lose some of the material in your mind, and you might end up having to rewind or redo a problem set. I mean, even I only use and in turn teach C in the fall semester every year, and so even I have to sort of refresh myself. So if you're spreading any class, especially CS50, out along that much time, like, you're probably just doing yourself a disservice. So I would try your best to keep up and try to aspire for less than a year being ideal, but people certainly succeed thereafter.
Yeah, and so one of the things you would learn if you took CS50X is how to build your very own software. So a question comes from someone in the chat here. Could you guide them on how to contribute to open source software?
Yeah, okay. So first, Carter, what do you mean by open source software?
Well, open source software is software for which the source code is open and online. The source code is the code you might write to actually build that software. Some folks, when they write software, put that code online for everyone to see, to contribute to as well.
Yeah, so companies like GitHub have been a big part of this. So if you go to github.com and you access any number of the repos or repositories that are on the website, you're looking typically at open source code. And if you can't see it at all, or if you get like a 404 message, it could very well be there. It's just it's private or closed source code. But GitHub and GitLab and Bitbucket and similar sites are all about making it easier to not just host your code and version control it, like keep track of different versions, but also make it very readily available to other people. So, to be honest, if you want to do something in the open source world, I think it's most fun and probably most straightforward if you pick some piece of software like a library or a framework or any piece of software that you yourself use or have used before, and if you spot a bug in it or if there's like a missing feature that you wish that tool could do, then you can minimally go to a website like github.com, go to the repo for that software, click on the issues tab and create an issue, which can mean any number of things. It can mean a bug report or it can mean a feature request. And I would just strongly encourage you, if you go that route, to just always be very detailed. Don't ask in a short term per sentence, what it is you're seeking or what it is you're reporting. Try to save the maintainers of the software the trouble of figuring out what is it you're seeing that they're not, so that they can really dive in and focus on the problem, not focus on the question that you're actually asking. And so examples might include if you do web development, like if you use Bootstrap, for instance, and you notice, oh, I wish Bootstrap did this, or oh, Bootstrap's not supposed to be doing that, you can open an issue, or better yet, what you can do once you're comfortable with the software is you could download the source code from GitHub, or technically clone the repository into your own account. You could then make changes using GitHub.com's GUI, or Bitbucket, or GitLab, whatever the case may be. You can then save the change in your repo, and then open what's called a pull request to the other repository, which essentially means you click a button, you create a name for it, maybe a description thereof, and that then shows the owners of the code that you cloned what changes literally you are proposing. And if they like them, they can literally click a button and merge the two together. If they don't like what you've done, or if they have questions or concerns, they can comment on it. So it's actually a really nice way to get into the ecosystem. And I'll say honestly, I think my proudest moment was there was not even a bug. I think it was like one line of a comment in English that was just incorrect. I think I might be making this up, but it was something like that. Very inconsequential. But I figured out how to actually clone this repository, submit the pull request, and in this case, it was to the Git source code itself. So the tool you actually use to use websites like GitHub and the like. And I was very proud when that finally got approved. But I spent like hours making sure I didn't embarrass myself by making sure I hadn't screwed up or done something wrong, so it can be time consuming too.
Yeah, and you make contributions both big and small, I guess.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Nice. One of the things I like about open source software is anyone around the world could contribute to it.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about our Spanish-speaking students, is there a version of CS50 in Spanish?
Sort of. So there has been in the past where we have actually had human translators translate the transcripts for the lectures in a format called SRT files, which are subtitle files, essentially in text format. We haven't done it over the past couple of years. It is our hope to do so again. In fact, on our to-do list is to put all of our transcripts or SRT files in a GitHub repository publicly so that people can submit pull requests. I will say that it is always, over the years, like such a bigger undertaking than people think it is, like for better or for worse, like a lot of words come out of my mouth and these are long lectures and then we have Doug Short's and yours and Brian's walkthrough, so it's a lot of content. So honestly, we're more optimistic moving forward that we're going to be able to leverage artificial intelligence and tools like from Microsoft and GitHub and OpenAI, Microsoft and Google and OpenAI to actually do these translations for us. And then maybe we humans just kind of make tweaks, but we don't translate every darn word, which just takes forever.
Yeah, and I think it's hard with so many variations of the course that we have the CS50X, CS50P, and so on.
Yeah.
And the question here is, how many variations are there actually in the CS50 universe?
I think there are 12 currently. Among them are indeed CS50X, which is like the backbone of the curriculum, but also quite rigorous. And so what you can take before that, or sometimes during or after, is CS50P, which is an introduction to programming with Python specifically. So it's not so much about CS and algorithms and data structures, it's about programming in Python. There's a similar class taught by Brian about Scratch, so similarly meant to be a very accessible class but focused on programming. We have introductions to computer science more generally for managers, people in business, for consumers and simple average citizens who just want to learn more about technology, and also for lawyers. And those classes too can be taken before or during or after CS50X itself. But then there are some follow-on classes too, soon to be Carter's own Introduction to Databases with SQL, another programming declarative language, a new class from me on cybersecurity debuting on
October 1st,
indeed. And then we have Brian's web programming class, Colton's game development class, and Brian's AI class. And if I had actually been putting up more than three fingers at a time, we'd know the final count, but I think it's 12.
Around 12. And
yes.
If that isn't enough, have you thought about a course on data science?
It's big O of 12. A course on data science. We have. It's not on the short-term to-do list, but we've been thinking about it, but no plans just yet.
A question from Abdura, I believe. When studying CS50, should I try to be proficient in every language in the course, like the C program, like Python, or so on, or just be well acquainted?
Well equipped or well acquainted?
Well acquainted. I think, yeah.
That's so, a fine line,
well,
I feel.
The question is proficient in every
language? Oh, proficient in every
language.
Versus
just kind of acquainted with it. well, minimally acquainted, yes. I think it's useful to know a bunch of different languages, not just to accumulate them on like your resume or your GitHub, but rather so that you know about different types of programming languages and different paradigms. Like there's procedural or imperative programming, there's declarative programming, there's functional programming, there's object-oriented programming, and there's overlap among some of those. But at least by seeing different languages, you see what's possible in code, and it makes it honestly easier to pick up new languages or new libraries or understand source codes, because you just have a bigger mental model of like how you can solve these kinds of problems. But I would say it's probably especially valuable to be proficient in, that is like very good at, minimally one, if not a couple of languages. And that can be a bunch of different popular ones nowadays, but you can't really go wrong with Python. If you're interested in data science, the question earlier, R is quite popular there. Java, super popular. JavaScript, super popular. And then if the web, you want to do web stuff, you have to know HTML and CSS, so your hands are somewhat tied. Then there's the whole mobile ecosystem. But in short, I would get breadth in a bunch of languages, but depth in at least one.
I agree with that. Yeah. Another question relatedly is, should someone try to do all of C50 courses, all 12 or all, well, around 12 courses that we just talked about?
No, probably not. I think doing all of the courses we offer would probably be equivalent to what the internet calls tutorial hell, where you, not because they're bad, but because you just get stuck in this infinite loop, if you will, of just like always learning, always practicing, but not necessarily applying. So it's fine to keep learning, but if you're not really taking that knowledge, those skills out for a spin and like solving actual problems, you're only solving my problems, Carter's problems, Brian's problems, Colton's problems, like you're not actually solving problems of your own or of your friends or family or colleagues. So we typically at Harvard College here, for instance, would recommend that minimally, before students go get a summer job or certainly a full-time job, that they take at least two software classes, like a class like CS50 in procedural programming, and then another class in functional or object-oriented programming, just to kind of round themselves out. If they can, maybe another class in algorithms and or data structures, so you go more deeply into that world. And after that, you can start to branch out more. But I don't think it would be a good prioritization of life to like sit down and not go off into the real world and like build your own things until you're done with all 12 of CS50's courses, which doesn't feel like an optimal use of time.
Probably not a good use of time.
I said optimal. You said good, but optimal.
Okay. One thing I like about those courses, though, is they're for beginners.
Yeah.
So if you were to begin learning computer science over again, would you do anything differently from how you first did it?
Oh, interesting. And as I answer this, if you want to tee up something for me to ask you, happy to take over the iPad.
Sure.
Would I do anything differently? So to this day, I kind of regret not having taken or made time for or had time for a course in graphics, whether it's for gaming or whatever else. A course in artificial intelligence proper back in the day. Like all of my knowledge is much more recent, but I wish I had taken a more foundational course early on, even though to be fair, it existed and the field existed some years ago, but it wasn't nearly as topical as it is right now. And I always wish I took a class in compilers. So in CS50, we talk about C and how you compile your code, so to speak, from higher level English-like syntax into zeros and ones. A compiler does that. And there's some really cool, fun, low-level code you can write to actually do compiler stuff. So I just wish that I had taken or had time to take a few more classes like that. And frankly, I wish I had found or made time over the past 20 years to do those as well, since I'm still interested, clearly.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Question about front-end development here, if you want to take
Sure, Carter, we have a question about front-end development here. What languages and frameworks should I be familiar with to be a good front-end developer?
So I think it's probably worth defining what front-end actually is.
Okay.
So if you're not familiar, front-end is what you see when you go to a new website, and you see often like some buttons or some text, some places you could type things in. That's what we call the front-end of some site. So if you want to build those kinds of designs, you might learn a few languages like HTML and CSS and JavaScript. But within those, there are a few tools or technologies you could use to help you use them all the more quickly. So for instance, something like Bootstrap, as I mentioned earlier, is a tool to help you write CSS to style your page to make them look really pretty really quickly. You might also learn things about JavaScript. I think Angular is a popular framework, React as well. Those help you build more interactive sites, again, a lot more quickly than you could just kind of on your own programming by yourself.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, another question we have here. Are CS50 certificates, perhaps from CS50 or edX, helpful in applying to Harvard, would you say?
So I think they could be. They're a great demonstration of your knowledge. If you've completed the course and gotten a certificate, that means you attempted all the problem sets, you got a good score on all of them. It kind of shows your knowledge, not just to Harvard, but to other folks who are interested in as well. So I'd say, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it certainly doesn't hurt. And I think if it's accompanied by other achievements, other projects, other goals that you've set your mind to, like, that's good. I don't think I would approach it as, oh, I should take CS50 at Harvard, get a certificate because it will help me get in here or anywhere else. It really should be part of a narrative. If you're taking advantage of resources, not just in your own school, but ideally, if your school itself is not very well resourced or doesn't have courses in CS, that you've gone above and beyond and found things on your own, and better yet, done more than just CS50, but have pursued higher level opportunities as well.
Yeah.
All right, so let's see. Another question here. Can you learn enough on CS50's course to start freelancing?
A really good question. Could you learn enough to do freelancing? So it probably depends on the freelancing you're thinking of doing. If you're interested in some front-end web development like we just talked about, or even back-end, or doing pretty much anything else with C or Python or HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, I would say CS50 is a good place to start for that. You could certainly get the fundamental skills you could learn to apply to new places and to show your skills to somebody who's looking to hire you, perhaps.
Okay, so, compelling. Yeah. We have another question here. What advice would you give to someone who is struggling with hash tables? And it's 1 a.m., haha.
If it's 1 a.m., my first advice is to take a break and go to sleep. Often the best thing you can do is just, if you're feeling stuck, feeling frustrated, just kind of take a step back, take some time to yourself, and then come back and approach the problem with that fresh mind and a more awake brain. For hash tables in particular, I found it helpful often just draw things out. So if you go to our own lectures, you go to Brian's walkthrough, Brian has some good visuals about what hash tables actually look like. I'd encourage you to take that, draw it out, and see what you're kind of missing in your mental model. Maybe add that drawing in to see if you can make it click in your mind. But again, after some sleep.
All right, so this one's a bit more specific to like pursuing a job. I've nearly completed CS50W, the web class, after CS50X. While applying for developer jobs, I see a lot of recruiters asking for a technical round of interviews. But how common is the use of DSA, data structures and algorithms, in web development, actually?
Good question. So if you're applying to technical roles at some company, you might often be asked to do this kind of technical interview, in which somebody will often give you a small coding problem that hopefully helps you demonstrate what you know about programming and all these fundamentals like data structures and algorithms. So I would say in a web developer role like that, you might get some questions about fundamental data structures and algorithms and so on, so it could be good to know about. Is that answering the question?
Yeah, I think so, because web development too, it depends on what depth it is. Like if you're just making static web pages with content, then no, like you shouldn't really need to know much about data structures and algorithms because it's really just HTML and CSS. But if you start writing JavaScript for more interactive code, interactive websites, well, you're going to be using things like arrays or objects or other data structures either that you've created or maybe some library has created. So then yes, it becomes more helpful. And also too, if you are the one architecting a full-fledged web application that has a front end and a back end, then yes, absolutely. And so like knowing something about data structures and algorithms is a good litmus test for just how deep your knowledge is versus how shallow it is. If you just know like HTML and CSS, like you're only going to be so useful on a team that's trying to build something, for instance, from the ground up. So it really depends too on the role that you're interested in.
I think most team members when they're hiring are interested in how you're thinking about the problem too. So it's less so the extent of your solution's correctness, but also more so how you talk them through how you're solving the problem, sharing your thinking as you go.
Yeah. All right, so here's a big one, Carter. Mm-hmm. I'm weak at problem solving. What should I do?
Weak at problem solving. I would say, I'm going to push back on that and say I don't think you're weak at problem solving. I think you have the tools within you to help solve problems. I wonder what kinds of problems you're trying to solve. Are they related to computer science in particular? Maybe feel free to follow up on that in the chat. But I would say, going back to some earlier question about being frustrated or feeling like you couldn't make progress on something, like take a step back, think about what you want to learn, and try to come back to that fresh mindset and thinking through, I can do this, I can try this, and that optimism should hopefully push you through a little bit further than currently now.
Yeah, and honestly, it really boils down to practice because, like, honestly, the real value of doing homework in many classes and just doing school in general is that you're not necessarily learning specifically how to solve problems that you're going to encounter in the real world, but problems that are similar to problems that you might encounter in the real world. And so by doing homework, taking classes, doing projects, writing papers, like, you're just learning to recognize patterns and apply those ideas to like problems in the real world. And honestly, that's what's so useful. If you have this mental model, so to speak, of some problem that you solved back in school or back at some other job, because when you encounter something new, you kind of have an instinct for a starting point. And that's absolutely going to be hard early on in school because you just don't have that mental model and you don't have those examples to draw on. So you just kind of have to power through because for better or for worse, like life is going to be filled with problems, not necessarily all CS, but you're just going to start to recognize how to navigate like things that are similar to past things.
Agreed.
I would say. All right, let's see. How about Carter? Is it good to take CS50W, the web class, and CS50 AI, the AI class, at the same time?
At the same time? I think it depends on the time you have available. Like, if you are interested in both those things, you have the time to devote to both courses, like, why not combine them and do them both at once? In my own educational trajectory, I found it helpful to take two kind of dissimilar courses and see how they related in ways I didn't quite expect. So I'd actually probably encourage you to try that out if you can. If it becomes overwhelming, feeling like you're spending too much time on it, feel free to do one and the other, either web first and then AI next, or AI first and web next. Either one, I would say.
Okay, fair. Let's see. How about any books you would advise for memorizing code or learning coding?
Books to memorize code. So I know there is a kind of famous book for the C programming language written by Brian Kern,
yeah.
Yeah, the author of that one. So that one's actually useful for me as I joined CS50 and wanted to learn how to teach C well. What is the title of the book? Do you know off the top of your head?
Programming in C. Programming in C. Wait, no. I really should know this. Everyone calls it K and R by nature of the authors. Wow, I should know this. This is embarrassing.
Something like programming in C, but if you can't find it, if you Google K and R.
We'll edit this part out, right? Okay.
Get Google K and R on Google, and you'll find this pretty small book on the C language. It kind of covers pretty much all of the you need to know about the C language. I found that helpful because I could go through and find all the bits and pieces of that language and see if I could combine them to build the programs I wanted to build. So it was good at breaking things down.
Sorry, it was even more obvious. The C programming language is what K and R is actually called. That's embarrassing, but...
So go ahead.
But you knew how big a book it was, so that was something.
Yeah, about that big.
Okay. All right, well, let's see. How much time, Carter, should someone spend learning coding to become a really good programmer?
So I've heard some conventional wisdom is the 10,000-hour rule. You spend 10,000 hours, you become an expert in whatever field you want to learn. I think it's from Malcolm Gladwell.
Okay, that's a lot of hours.
That's a lot of hours. I don't think that's quite always accurate. I think it more so depends on the kind of practice you're doing. So the kinds of practice that you might get from CS50 is that practice of actually writing code, solving new problems. That's what I think is kind of valuable practice you might need. So I don't think there's a certain number of hours, but more so the kinds of, the type of practice you're doing, and I would say more so a commitment to staying with it. Like, if you do it this next month, try to do it the next month, too. And 1 month leads to two to three, maybe a whole year leads to two, and so on. You find yourself becoming more and more expert as you go.
Yes, but I would emphasize, or I would argue that you should still be applying what you're learning as you go, because if you're assuming like 40 hours in a week, that's 250 weeks to get to 10,000 hours. No. And that's so like 5 years. And I don't think someone should wait 5 years before feeling that they're like ready to emerge from tutorial hell.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I have heard that heuristic before as well. All right, how about time for a few more questions here? Let's see, a lot of people in the chat who knew the name of the textbook before we did.
All right.
Okay.
I'm proud of you all.
All right, so this is a question really for the group, so others should feel to chime in too. But did you all take classes for fast typing? How about you?
I actually did. We had this was back in middle school when I was maybe around 13 or 14. We had a program, I don't remember the name, but there was a wizard that would show up, and you'd be on a spaceship, and you'd, like, type words fast enough to break the asteroids. So maybe others have played that game.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I don't know what games or software were used, but I, too, in middle school, I think, and this was, like, in the 80s, and they had these very cheesy, like, pieces of plastic that they'd put over your hands so you couldn't cheat and look at your actual fingers.
That's tough.
Yeah, and... You know, it's funny, to this day, I don't think I type properly because I think the way we were supposed to type was like keeping your hands positioned and just moving your fingers, but I still kind of move my hands and it's just kind of what feels most comfortable to me.
Is that good for your wrist? Or
I don't know. Maybe not. But that's what I do.
Nice.
I mean, in fairness, actually, in graduate school years ago, I did start to develop problems with my hands, which wasn't so much a function, I think, of how I was typing, but really how I was sitting. And I developed what would generally be called RSI, repetitive stress injuries. And it was really worrisome and really potentially debilitating, such that I'd have to take a few days away from typing, or at least typing significantly, because I didn't want to do more damage. And I knew at the time a couple of friends had serious physical issues that had been the result of poor ergonomics, so to speak. Okay. And so what I found helpful for years in my case was I got not really a special desk, but a special keyboard tray that actually didn't sit flat, but actually angled downward, because I found it more comfortable to type like this for a while. And I don't need that anymore, and even now I do think I'm a little lazy, and if I'm on the sofa with my laptop, those are not the best ergonomics, but I don't think I type as much as I once did on that way. So I would be super careful, and if you're ever feeling any pain in your wrists or hands or forearm, like, stop and fix whatever it is you're doing and take time away from it if you can.
Posture's important.
Yeah, no, that was a worrisome time years ago. All right, how about, this is harder to answer, I dare say, but what language has the most potential for being the most profitable in the current world?
The most profitable. I would say that answer is probably always changing in some sense. I know there are surveys, like by Stack Overflow, that try to figure that out. I know you showed one recently, like in our business school class. Is there one that topped that list? You remember?
I don't remember what it was, but if you do Google Stack Overflow Developer Survey, you will see some numbers there where they surveyed thousands of folks, which might help. I suspect atop the list,
JavaScript.
You know, JavaScript, Java, like a lot of enterprise-focused languages. Probably some more niche or older languages where there's just fewer people who know them well is possible. But honestly, I wouldn't learn a language strictly because it's on the top of one of these lists. I would take one step back from that and consider, like, where or from whom are you going to learn it well and enjoy it ideally, and two, like, what opportunities might exist, like in your local town or community or online, and maybe strategize that way. And I don't think you can really go wrong.
Agreed. Because again, it's always changing. So learn what you want to learn and what's going to help you best type into computer science.
Yeah, agreed. I'm confused between cybersecurity and AI. How can I find which is better for me?
I would probably take stock of your interests. So cybersecurity might be interesting to you if you're interested in how we can secure systems, keep data private, keep hackers out, or even how you could hack organizations, presumably for good, to help them find their own vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm.
You might be interested in AI, though, if you're curious about maybe taking in lots of data and finding patterns in that data. If you've been interested in some of the recent developments in ChatGPT or generative AI, ones can make artwork and text and so on, that might be a good reason to go study AI. So it kind of depends on your own interests here and taking stock of what you like the best.
Yeah, okay. Let's see, I've got to do C++ for my university class, but is it okay to learn concepts like OOP or DSA in Python?
I would say it's still okay. Python tends to, we say, abstract some of those structures away, so you get a lot of things for free in Python. If you, for instance, want to make a linked list in Python, you get that, especially typing like a single line of code. In C++ or in C, takes many more lines of code. You kind of build it up yourself. So I would say C++ or C might be better to actually understand how the structures are built from the beginning, but Python can help you use them more quickly as you develop in your career.
Okay, fair. Yeah. I think we have time for a couple more questions. All right. Let's see. I got one for our last question.
I'm going to ask that one to you, or?
Oh, we should both answer it, I think. How about this one, though? Because we hear this a lot from a lot of our online or adult students. Do we have any future in the job market at the age of 49?
Absolutely. I think we're always looking for programmers of all ages, so it's never too late to begin, never too late to put yourself out there onto that job market.
Yeah, no, and truly, certainly when it comes to technical skills, I don't think people blink twice whether you're young, whether you're old. It really boils down to, in most contexts, or many contexts certainly, like just how good you are at what you do, and particularly with so many online opportunities available nowadays, increasingly work from home, wherever you are in the state, wherever you are in the country or in the world, that's opening up potentially new opportunities too. So I certainly wouldn't let age alone be a barrier if you have like this interest, if you have opportunities to learn it, be it online or in person. Like, I think that should really be lower on your list of concerns.
Definitely.
How about for our final question? It's a bit open-ended, but also I think it's provocative. Mm-hmm. What about the future of programming?
Ooh. One thing that comes to my mind immediately is I think you had shared this talk with me and Rong Shin, one of our software developers on the team, where someone was talking about the capabilities of generative AI, like ChatGPT, to help us write code. So if you go to ChatGPT, it'll help you write code. It can be a little too helpful sometimes. But I think there might be a transition towards writing code in more of an English language style, mm-hmm. like trying to tell an AI what you want the program to do, and having it generate the code for you that you can then go in and critique and update with your own knowledge of that language. Does that make sense?
I agree. I don't know how many years away it is, but I would be thrilled, honestly, if I could just tell an AI what it is I want some application or software to do for me, so long as it interprets me correctly and I can be as imprecise with the AI as I might be with a human who can read between the lines and know what I mean, whereas computers typically won't give you the benefit of the doubt in that way. And I think, too, if I had to guess, in some number of years, a lot of software engineering will become more like product management and actually designing the software at a high level, but like leaving it to the software itself to write itself, if you will. So you and I can focus honestly on the interesting parts of the problem, the juicy parts, like what are the feature sets, how does it work, what's the overarching design, but you don't have to necessarily get into the weeds of writing code that might be fun in some cases, but a lot of it increasingly is becoming boilerplate, gets a little repetitive, it's similar to some other project you did, it's just using API calls or using someone else's library, and there's just the juicy part, honestly, even when Rong Shin and I and we sort of talk about software, it's like literally using the whiteboard or just kind of chatting open-endedly about what the software should do and how it could do it. Honestly, at least for me, like that's the fun part of all of this. It's the design, and I do enjoy some of the coding, but honestly, I also have to take such a deep breath sometimes to just slog through other aspects of coding or find enough time to do everything that it's a real turnoff. So I think there's like a real juicy opportunity there.
Yeah, and we talk about one of the things computer science teaches you is how to be precise, so all the more reason to learn computer science then.
Yeah. Well, if you'd like to learn more about where we are in the world, Google Radcliffe College, which is now the Radcliffe Institute. You can read more about the history here. We, of course, are here representing CS50, which is Harvard's introduction to the intellectual enterprises of computer science and the art of programming, with all of these follow along and also precursor courses that we've chatted about a bit here. And you can find all of those at edx.org/CS50. Any final words for the group?
None for me. See you next time.
This was CS50.